It's just the best news ever. I waited for 16 years and I fought for my son for 16 years.
A new confession in the stomping death of a Fairbanks teen in 1997. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Anchorage attorney wins a MacArthur Genius Grant for her innovative thinking on immigration reform.
The current situation is not tenable. We've created this complex, dysfunctional system, and something needs to be done.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVimaging.com.
Hundreds of Alaska Natives gathered outside the state courthouse in Fairbanks this afternoon to hear news about a murder case that's long raised questions about whether justice was served. Four Fairbanks men, three of whom are Alaska Native, are serving long sentences for the 1997 stomping death of local teen John Hartman. The case of the Fairbanks Four lacked physical evidence and has been reexamined in recent years by local Native advocates and the Alaska Innocence Project. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the group say new evidence shows the jailed men are innocent.
A man who lived in Fairbanks back in 1997 and is now in prison for life in California for another murder has detailed the attack on John Hartman. Alaska Innocence Project Director Bill Oberle says William Holmes tells a story of he and four friends carrying out random violence.
According to his statement, it was something that they did at that time for fun. They came downtown and harassed people, and John Hartman was an unfortunate victim of that.
Holmes pins the actual killing on former high school classmate Jason Wallace, who's also currently in prison for another crime. The story is corroborated by another friend of Wallace's, who says Wallace admitted to the Hartman attack when they were in high school. Oberle says there's reason to believe Holmes is telling the truth.
Well, there is corroboration for what he said, if you read the pleading. And I know that one might question the veracity of someone who's in prison, but you also have to ask why would he come forward?
The new information is the centerpiece of lengthy applications for post-conviction relief filed on behalf of the men convicted of the Hartman killing, George Fries, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent.
We are sure that they will find, as we have found, that the evidence that is contained in this document and the evidence that's out there proves that Marvin, George, Eugene, and Kevin are innocent, and that we will prevail in that regard. So.
The mother of Marvin Roberts, Hazel Roberts Mayo, expressed joy at the new development in the case.
It's just the best news ever. I waited for 16 years and I fought for my son for 16 years. And it's paying off. I knew he was innocent from day one.
Roberts Mayo says her happiness will be topped when her son walks free. That's now up to law enforcement and the court system. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
It's been about a week since fire ripped through Glenwood Manor, a 38-unit apartment complex in the Mountain View neighborhood of Anchorage. Investigators are trying to figure out the cause. In the meantime, 32 people are still living at a Red Cross shelter at the Fairview Recreation Center, which was supposed to close today. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Even though Fa'amatua Messick and her family lost nearly all their belongings in the Glenwood Manor apartment complex fire in the Mountain View neighborhood of Anchorage last week, Messick says she has a lot to be thankful for. She says they're sleeping on cots or on the floor. They have a place to bathe, and they're fed. The kids are going to school every day. She rummages through a Walmart plastic bag full of donated clothes she's carrying around the shelter, now her only real belongings.
They gave us some dresses, pants, shirts, also some socks for the kids that's from Walmart, and some sweatpants too, some ladies' clothes, you know.
Messick staying at the Red Cross shelter along with nine of her family members who were sharing a two-bedroom apartment. She moved to Anchorage in May from Hawaii with her three kids, 16, 11, and 8. Her husband joined them at the beginning of September. The family is originally from Samoa and moved to Alaska for opportunity. They were staying with Messick's sister, brother-in-law, and their three kids while her husband looked for work. Messick explains that she and her husband are trying to find a new place to live, but they're overwhelmed.
My schedule is to go try to get a newspaper, look for a place or wherever, then we can go there and check it out. But the problem is I don't have that much money for first payment and a security deposit. That's another thing that's holding us back because we just moved here. We don't have that much money.
Other shelter residents are having an easier time getting back on their feet. Jay Phillips had lived at the Glenwood Manor complex for more than 20 years. Now he's waiting to move into a new apartment. Phillips went back to his apartment this week to see if he could salvage anything, but Cruz told him his apartment was so wrecked that he wasn't allowed back in.
I was allowed to stand about at least 4 feet away from the front door and take a look at the damage. Of course, it's pretty devastating.
As a single person, Phillips says he found the place pretty easily through NeighborWorks, a nonprofit that helps people find affordable housing. He located a two-bedroom apartment on Government Hill for about the same price as his old one.
I haven't seen it yet, but I was told it's pretty nice. They got carpet layers, putting carpet in, stuff like that. That's what they told me. Either late this afternoon or tomorrow morning. So hopefully pretty soon.
But for Messick, the wait to get into a new place is likely to be much longer. A Red Cross worker told Messick she could apply for aid of up to $500 to help her get into a new place. But with the average rent for a two-bedroom apartment around $1,200 plus a deposit, Messick is worried. Even if they find a place, she's not sure how they'll pay for it.
But I'm trying to think who to ask if they can help us for that, for the first month and the security deposit if we find a place. So I don't know where to go.
Red Cross officials say they plan to keep the shelter open through Friday, but just for sleeping and breakfast, in hope that those displaced by the fire will have new homes by week's end. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Two people are confirmed dead and a third is believed to have died in a boating incident on the lower Yukon River near Lugenuk. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The deceased have been identified as 29-year-old Daniel Noble and 50-year-old Cyril Murphy. Presumed dead is 24-year-old Stanton Shelton, who is still being sought by searchers. All men are from the village of Nunamaqua, south of Alaganak on the Bering Sea coast. There was one survivor, John Chigagak, age 21. The incident happened at about 6 p.m. Monday, 10 miles downriver from Alaganak. Troopers responded from the St. Mary's Post. Megan Peters, spokeswoman for the troopers, says so far they only know what Chigagak has been able to tell them. The four men had all been traveling in the same boat.
According to him, there was a crack in the boat and it had filled up with some water and they had been attempting to bail the water out. And when it wasn't working, they decided to pull the drain plug on it and attempt to plane the boat so the water would go out as the boat was planing. And that is something that can work. However, the motor that they had on the skiff wasn't strong enough to accomplish this. So instead of emptying the water out, it became swamped.
Chigagak says he was able to swim to shore after taking off a lot of his clothing. He survived the night and was found the following day by boaters. The incident was first noticed around noon on Tuesday by boaters who came across a body on the riverbank. They found a second person who was dead, floating in the water. Both had been wearing their life jackets. Several local volunteers are out in their boats today helping in the search effort to find Shelton. Peter says local search volunteers are always appreciated.
Anytime we have a search and rescue going on out in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, we have found that people in the communities really come together.
Over a dozen boats started searching this morning at about 9 a.m. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look at insurance rates in Alaska under the Affordable Care Act.
It's going to be a shock to the consumer who's paying for their own health insurance right now. They're gonna be in for it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Enroll Alaska, helping educate and enroll Alaskans in health insurance under the federal mandate created by the Affordable Care Act. Learn more at enrollingalaska.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Alaskans will be paying some of the highest premiums in the country for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The federal government released today the first glimpse of rates on the state's federally run health insurance marketplace, which launches next week. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The average monthly premium in Alaska for a mid-level health insurance plan will cost $474 a month. That's according to a new report from the federal government that gives examples of rates for 47 states. Wyoming is the only state where rates will be higher than Alaska. Joshua Weinstein is a consultant at Northrim Benefits Group in Anchorage.
It's going to be a shock to the consumer who's paying for their own health insurance right now. They're gonna be in for it.
For example, Weinstein says a 35-year-old male who's paying $180 a month for a plan today will pay nearly $300 for a similar plan starting in 2014. But under the Affordable Care Act, the new plans will offer more comprehensive coverage, including no lifetime maximum benefit limits and no exclusions for pre-existing conditions. Weinstein's company is hoping to help thousands of Alaskans sign up for coverage, but he says it won't be easy to convince everyone who's eligible to make the leap, even though if they don't, they'll have to pay a small tax penalty.
If someone's not subsidy eligible and they're a healthy 35-year-old, I think it's a tough argument, and I think that would be a very challenging sell. However, if that 35-year-old's got medical issues and have pre-existing conditions and needs things done, I think that changes the conversation. They would be able to access health care for the first time.
And Weinstein says many 35-year-olds will be eligible for a subsidy to help pay for insurance, which will make it much more enticing. In Alaska, a person who earns less than $57,000 a year will qualify for a subsidy. And in some cases, the subsidy will be so generous, the insurance will be free. That's true for a family of four in Alaska with an income of $50,000 if they choose the most basic coverage.
The subsidies really are going to, in my opinion, are the cutting edge to whether or not someone buys health care.
Two companies, Moda Health and Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, will offer plans on Alaska's health insurance marketplace. Weinstein says based on his review of rates from both carriers, it looks like Primera's plans will cost about 15% more than Moda's. But Weinstein says Primera has better name recognition in the state and offers other incentives, like a much wider network of out-of-state providers. Alaskans should be able to do their own comparison shopping starting October 1st at healthcare.gov. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
An Anchorage immigration attorney is a MacArthur Genius Grant winner. Margaret Stock was named today, along with 23 other recipients across the country. The honor comes with a $625,000 award over the next 5 years. Stock is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserves, and she's a passionate advocate for simplifying the immigration system and makes the case that immigrants enhance national security. She says the September 11th attacks might have been prevented if we had more people who spoke foreign languages in the military.
And that really troubled me. And then especially after 9/11, there was a response of, well, let's just keep all the immigrants out of America, as if somehow that was going to make us safer. And in fact, at that point, it was really crucial to take advantage of all the immigrant talent because we had lots of people that we could have working on our side who spoke foreign languages and who were culturally aware of what was going on and who could help us fight the forces of evil that were trying to attack us. And it seemed to me that we were very short-sighted. And with the post-9/11 crackdown on immigration, a lot of people in the military were having problems with their family members, with themselves. The system was getting more and more complicated and more bureaucratic, and people were falling afoul of very technical provisions of the rules and regulations, or their family members weren't getting the right piece of paper filed on time, and it was causing all kinds of problems. So everyone was calling me because I was the only one who understood immigration law. I got so inundated with calls that I didn't have any time to do my work. So I called the president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and I asked him if he could possibly set up a pro bono program to help out all these military families. And to give him credit, he immediately agreed. And the pro bono program still exists today. It's called the American Immigration Lawyers Association Military Assistance Program. And we've helped literally thousands of military families with their immigration problems.
Let's dissect that a little bit. I think that some people may be surprised to find that folks in the military were having trouble after September 11th. What kind of impact have you seen on military families because of immigration restrictions after the September 11th attacks?
Well, they're the same kind of problems everyone else is having. They're just magnified by the fact that somebody's in the military, and so they can't necessarily deal with things as well because they might be deployed, they might be in a combat zone, they might be traveling, their address is changing frequently. They're under all the stresses that people in the military suffer in wartime. So it's just harder for them to deal with the complex bureaucracy that is involved in getting your status, keeping your status legal, and getting it legal in the first place. And I think it's interesting to me, but most Americans have no idea what the immigration system is like today. You know, you hear people complaining about the Internal Revenue Service and its complex bureaucracy, but the immigration system is 10 times worse. The rules and regulations are convoluted. They're often arbitrary. There are many different cabinet-level agencies involved in regulating immigration, and they have conflicting policies. And unless you have an expert standing by your side, you can't cope with this. It's just not possible.
Were there any stories that particularly resonated with you coming out of those conflicts?
Oh, sure. One was Carla Rivera. She was a Navy sailor. She joined the Navy with a green card, but it was a conditional green card based on her marriage to a U.S. citizen. And she applied for citizenship while she was in the Navy. And the Navy lawyer told her that she didn't need to extend her green card because she had applied for citizenship. Well, the next thing she knew, she got a letter from Homeland Security saying she was going to be deported because she hadn't extended her green card. And so she was facing deportation. And they were telling her that if she didn't show up in front of a judge for her immigration hearing in California, that she would be ordered deported in her absence. And she was on a ship in Norfolk, Virginia, and she was going to have to fly to California at her own expense to show up at this hearing. And the Navy wasn't going to pay for it, and she's supposed to be on her ship. And, you know, it turned into this big mess. And ultimately it was resolved because we got her a pro bono lawyer who could explain to the judge that she's in the Navy and she has a citizenship application pending and so forth. But you know, cases like that were happening all the time. And that's an example of a military member they were trying to deport. And it was all because she didn't file a piece of paper that the lawyer for the Navy told her she did not have to file.
Have you seen a shift in the conversation about immigration in the last decade? Since the September 11th attacks, when immigration has become more of a national focus and the conversation has kind of ebbed and flowed, what do you see today compared to right after the attacks happened? Has it gotten better or has it gotten worse when we're talking about what should be happening with immigration?
I think people are universally in agreement, with a few exceptions, that the current situation is not tenable, that we've created this complex, dysfunctional system and something needs to be done. And I think there was less awareness of that after 9/11. But I think it's been obvious with more than 10 years now having gone by that we don't have a system that serves our national interest. So I think there's pretty much universal agreement on that. What's not clear is what we're going to do about it. And I think people still don't really understand what's going on. They try to simplify things into, you know, pretty 30-second sound bites about this is going to solve everything. And this is a complex problem that has just festered for decades now. And there has not been any good solution to it that has been implemented effectively. Now, there are things that we could do. One of the big things we should be doing, which we're not, is simplifying the system instead of making it more and more and more complicated.
What are you planning to do with the money?
Everyone asks that, and the honest answer right now is I don't know yet, because this just happened, and I have to process the information and try to figure it out. I do know that I want to do something that's going to advance the causes that I care about passionately. So I have to think about it to try to figure out how I'm going to get the biggest bang for the buck. But I'm sure I'm going to be doing something related to immigration and national security.
Margaret Stock is a winner of the 2013 MacArthur Genius Grant.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Haines Highway is a stretch of road north of Haines to the Canadian border and toward Alaska's interior. The two-lane road follows a prolific salmon river, travels through the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve, and crisscrosses native cultural sites. And while the project to expand the highway has been in the works for years, a recent influx of concern about its impact on the Chilkat Valley has slowed its progress. From member station KHNS, Margaret Friedenauer reports.
The $130 million project would widen and straighten the Haines Highway, replace an aging bridge, and bring the road up to a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit. The project began in 2005, and it's taken nearly 8 years to secure most of the funding. It's also estimated to take about that long to complete the entire 22 miles of highway expansion once the project begins next year. But in the last few months, people who treasure the designated scenic byway have started voicing concerns about the project. More than 250 comments were received by the state during the official comment period. Jeremy Woodrow with the State Department of Transportation says that response has slowed down the project.
The high number of comments did slow the process down, and we're making sure that we respond to every single comment appropriately.
Woodrow says the state is also going through some design changes in response to the comments. That could be good news for people and organizations who are stressing they support a safer highway, but without jeopardizing eagle and salmon habitat. The National Audubon Society is concerned about eagles. The National Marine Fisheries Service worries about the effects on Chilkat River fish habitat. Some local residents are also concerned about the project's effect on cultural resources. The highway corridor is dotted with sites important to Tlingits in the region. Harriet Brulette with the Chilkoot Indian Association told the Assembly recently that few non-natives understand the significance of the area. But the highway has slowly encroached on the Yendestucky site, where her family is from and where she has a family member buried.
It's a burial ground for my family. We have a medicine man in my family who is buried there, and the road is getting closer and closer to his burial site.
Mayor Stephanie Scott has her own concerns about the project. As mayor, she is also the chair of the Bald Eagle Preserve's Advisory Council. And her biggest concern is the road project's effect on salmon. She says the salmon are the key to a healthy eagle population and to the local economy. But she also believes the state is doing what it can to avoid having to do an environmental impact statement, a process that could delay the project for years. To avoid that, Scott believes the state is taking steps to mitigate environmental effects.
If they are looking for a finding of no significant impact, then they have to achieve no significant impacts in their project design.
But Scott says there should be a way to meet the needs of both humans who need a safe transportation corridor and the wildlife that call it home.
I sometimes feel like we lose sight of the human habitat and what we need for to prosper and flourish and not kill ourselves. I mean, we don't want to kill eagles and we don't want to kill humans. And if we can design in order to increase the probability of safety for animals and humans because we share the space, then we really should do that.
Reporting from Haines, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
One of Alaska's tourism pioneers passed away over the weekend. Stan Stevens was 79 years old. He was known for his popular charter boat line that provided tours in the Prince William Sound. KCHU's Tony Gorman has this remembrance.
When tourists want an up-close look at the Columbia Glacier, they went to Stan Stevens Cruises. When there is a convention or conference in Valdez and the locals want to show off the Prince William Sound, they called on Stan Stevens Cruises to help them have a good time. Stan Stevens' boats have been sailing the Prince William Sound for 42 years. To many in the area and the state, he was more than just a charter boat owner. That's according to his daughter, Colleen, who took over as president of his business in recent years.
Across Valdez, much less Prince William Sound and lots of the state of Alaska that have many lessons they learned from, dealing with one another, to negotiating and fighting for things that you believe in, to having passion for what you commit your life to, whether that is your business or your family or activist issues that you choose to follow behind.
The Minnesota native came to Alaska in 1961. He started out by camping on vacant property. He later purchased land and built his home in North Pole. 3 years later, he married his wife, Mary Helen, and began raising his three daughters. He worked as a mechanic while exploring the state on the weekend. During those trips, he fell in love with the Prince William Sound and founded his first company, North Star Marine Charters. The business specialized in hunting and fishing tours. It later evolved into Stan Stevens Charters in 1978, which still provides sightseeing tours of glaciers and wildlife of the Prince William Sound. Stevens' business was very popular among locals and tourists. It also helped the area recover from one of the most devastating events in U.S. history. Stevens lent his vessels to assist response efforts during the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. He acquired more vessels to maintain his full tour schedule. Colleen says that was a critical point in her dad's life.
He fully dedicated his life at that point on to dedicate Prince William Sound, make sure it is the safest oil shipping port, ensure that industry, the environment, and the communities in Prince William Sound could work together to come up with the ways to get it to be that safe port.
Stevens would do that by joining the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, a citizens' oversight group dedicated to the environmentally safe operations of the Valdez Marine Terminal and the tankers who use it. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Finally tonight, we have a correction. In a story aired last evening about Alaska lawmakers attending the Energy Council meeting in Wyoming, Anchorage Senator Kathy Geisel was mistakenly identified as being a Fairbanks senator. We apologize for the error. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, and Tony Gorman in Valdez. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Calling all Alaskan artists, Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.